Yo, everybody, welcome to episode 28 of your favorite podcast, Techish. I'm back again, Michael Behane, the CEO and co-founder of peopleofcolorintech.com, and I'm joined with the brilliant, the amazing, the wonderful...
Woohoo, Abadesi, of Hustle Crew and Product.
You almost forgot where you're from.
Yeah, like, what are you again? I was like, where am I? Who
That's
am
how
I?
Hard Abba works. You forget where you're from. Yeah. All right, cool. Let's take a stab at our first story. Interesting article that I read on the Harvard Business Review website. I love to say Harvard like that because it's just a special place. Harvard. And they're basically looking at like what is the average age of successful founders, and they're kind of saying how actually, despite what the media presents, and when I say media, I basically mean TechCrunch. I'm singling you guys out. They were basically saying that the average age of successful founders based on tracked by growth, sales, and IPOs.
Yeah.
So it's not just like, oh, profitability, you old people, you have to make profitable businesses and you don't do nothing big.
Yeah.
Growth, sales, and IPOs. 45 is the sweet spot, is the golden age.
Wow.
And that actually, they then, which is I thought was really clever, they went and analyzed the average age of the founders that win TechCrunch Awards, which is why I singled them out. 31.
Ooh.
And they even break it down. I love this quote. So if you were faced with two entrepreneurs and you knew nothing about them besides their age, you would do better on average betting on the older one.
Wow.
Which is like the exact opposite thesis I think that most investors have had. Like Paul Graham was famously quoted saying that after 32, like he kind of like thinks like, not sure.
Yeah.
So is this ageism? Is it just like, I don't know what, like, why are we so blind to this kind of stuff?
I think definitely, like we've spoken about before, tech does have like an ageism issue. We're a bit obsessed. And this isn't exclusive to tech, right? It's just exclusive of all like media headlines. Like youngest person to, I don't know, sail to the moon or whatever.
Baby and does X. Embryo does X.
Yeah. And there are so many people that I meet in the work that I do that are like, oh, I'm so old. And I'm like, okay, well, if you think you're old and you're like 24.
Yeah, I'm black dumb crack, so they think you're 24 as well. Trust me.
I don't even want to tell
22,
you.
Trust me.
How old I am. Thanks, man. But like, yeah, I definitely think we have this sort of like ageism in tech, which doesn't actually correlate with the data. So I'm pretty sure, you know, if you're a VC out there or you work for a VC fund, you can do some quick arithmetic in your head to get the average age of your portfolio founders. And it's definitely going to be skewing on the older side of 30s than the younger side of 30s. And I think what happens is we have a few incubators and accelerators, you know, like Y Combinator, that have very close connections to universities and have some really famous university dropout founders.
Right.
And then we sort of make this assumption, almost like confirmation bias at work in our head,
yeah,
that people who are tech founders are often college dropouts and insanely young and gifted. The Stripe brothers as well, you know, dropped out of college and started their business.
Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, they were kids.
Exactly. But I, you know, I know from VC events that I've been to and speaking to funds that I know, interestingly enough, even early stage ones, most of their founders are not first-time founders. I'd probably say like at least half of a portfolio on average is someone that's like trying for the second, third, fourth time, maybe even someone who's had an exit before. So by that law, people must be older, right?
Yeah, and it's really weird because like I think tech people love to pride themselves on being contrarian. And like, I think at one point it was contrarian to back the young person because it was like the MBA in the suit was getting the money. So like, okay, we'll just go for the young, like hungry engineer who's 19 or whatever that wants to eat ramen noodles or whatever, right? But now I think it's actually anti-consensus to actually back the older founder because that is now goes against the thing. And I think funds that are like, I wouldn't say actively looking for older founders, but funds that are open to older funders will probably see greater returns, at least according to this data.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
I think about that as well. So whenever I go to like pitch competitions or whatever, people are always talking about, well, when I started Hustle Crew 2 years ago, it was like, oh, the millennial this, the millennial that. Now it's all about Gen Z. And what's so interesting is the people that actually have money in society right now, or at least the most, you know, spare cash.
Right.
Are old people.
The grey dollar, the grey pound, they call it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So maybe someone, I mean, if you take this idea, you got to cut me in. But someone should start a fund for like founders that are making ideas for that generation.
Maybe, yeah, you're right.
There was someone that made like a dating app, like Tinder for parents.
I saw one, Tinder for mums. Or maybe you're right, it's Tinder for parents.
Exactly.
It's Tinder for older people.
But like baby boomers, so like over 50s. I mean, Tinder doesn't have an upper age restriction.
But you know what time it is.
Exactly.
You know what time it is.
So I think what's also good about that as well is like, or just this headline in general, is like, take comfort in yourself if you're like 25 right now and you haven't like got your winning idea.
Right.
Because the average age of people that are actually getting funding for winning ideas are 20 years older than you.
So here's the proof of the pudding. I got that phrase completely wrong. So question to Abba. Would you consider yourself to be a better entrepreneur now or when you were younger?
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, I want to say now just because I have more data and information. However, when I was younger, there's some kind of risk taking that comes with naivety.
Okay.
I think.
Right.
And like an observation that I've made is, you know, the older I get and the more aware I become of things like my mortality and like, I don't know, I just guess like existential risks all around me, the more careful I become to some degree.
I get what you're saying.
I mean, that's definitely outweighed by the abundance of like information I now have to draw upon when it comes to trying to solve problems or make connections and build my network. However, like one of the things that I truly admire in like lots of the teen makers, for example, that I meet at Product Hunt or at events, is that utopianism and positivity and like creativity that comes with the naivety of youth, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I get that.
And I don't mean to sound condescending at all, because I am still naive myself.
I mean, you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly.
So you're willing to tackle big hard problems, maybe. I mean, that's the theory, and that's what was, you know, the Paul Grahams of the world genuinely believe. One thing I would say that we haven't talked about is, you mentioned it briefly, network.
Yes.
And I think, you know, we always talk about networking, but a big part of networking is that as you get older, your friends just become like more high status. It's just, it happens just by happenstance. Like
when
I was 21, so for example, my five closest friends, when I was 21, we came out of uni, what connections did we have? Now I'm 30, my five best friends are like, you know, successful musician, a podcaster, super successful cybersecurity person, VCs now, like some of them are. So it's like, just by growing older, I have better connections. So if I have like a retail product, I probably could know the person who's the buyer now at Sainsbury's, at Tesco, just because we're older. Like, whereas when you're 20 years old, who the hell do you know? That's when you're 20, being a really good networker is an advantage, because then you can network up. Whereas sometimes just being older, you can network sideways and you've got connects there ready for you. Like,
I feel like I have two observations on that. One of the beauties of the Gen Z generation is that they've always had the internet, and so they've been entrepreneurial since their childhood.
Yeah.
So what's interesting about that is that, you know, these sort of connections that we can now boast because we're X years into working, they probably could already have them, even though they're 10 years younger than us, assuming they're in like a super entrepreneurial friendship group, or they've met other people through the internet. They maybe haven't even met these people in real life,
on
but
IG
they're doing
and whatever, like,
business pitches together. And then the second observation I'll make about that is like, it's a really good metaphor for privilege.
Yeah.
What you're describing.
Yeah.
Because what you're talking about is basically being like an ordinary person that went to, you know, state-funded school, then university, and started working. And now, as you know, by virtue of being with other hardworking people, people are now in certain statuses that they can benefit each other. Well, when you come from a super privileged background and your dad's, you know, playing golf with the CEO of whatever,
your uncle is this already,
you're
like,
just, those are the connections you have from day dot.
Yeah,
so you're
talk.
Just like, that's how you get the internship at, you know, Goldman when you're like 15 or whatever. Like that's, so that's privilege.
I remember having an internship. I don't want to make this a poor me story. And like, I had to go for like five rounds to get in.
I'll get the little
like,
violin out. It's okay.
Yeah, sorry. Right. And then I got it, right? I went for five rounds, everything. And then I got in, and the other interns were all just giving it to them by their parents who worked at the company.
Wow.
And they were like, oh my God, so you had to do all of this stuff. I was like, anyways, we'll call it a day. That's it. Like, a lot of food for thought. So this really made me like it. I guess it is kind of super patronizing and super upsetting, but it is also kind of funny just how cheeky companies can get.
Yeah.
So Netflix has been personalizing the cover art of your film. So let's say you're scrolling through Netflix, you're chilling, maybe you're looking for your phone at the same time, and there's a poster for a film, and it's got two black actors on the poster.
Oh, nice.
Okay, cool, right? So what Netflix is doing is showing you people that might be, like, the side characters or, like, are barely in the film, but because they know, based off your previous watch history, that you might like black content, and they're assuming maybe that you may be black, they're now tweaking the cover art of the film to reflect your interest and taste.
Oh, my god!
Yeah, so people were like, yo, like, so for example, the film Love Actually.
Yeah.
I've forgotten the guy's name. He's a Nigerian actor.
There's black people in that.
There's the guy from 12 Years a Slave who's in that, basically.
Oh, my god!
He's in it for, like, 10 minutes. He's a side character. And, like, for a lot of African Americans, a lot of black people in the UK have noticed that he's on the cover art for Love Actually when they're scrolling through their Netflix selections. So is this like optimization gone to like its logical conclusion, where you're like, if you want to optimize and say, I want people to engage massively with my product.
Yeah.
And you know that just by looking at the data, people engage massively this way.
Yeah.
Is there anything wrong with that?
That's so interesting, because that's basically like artificial intelligence using the concept of framing.
Yeah.
You know, what you're being selective about the data you present to increase the probability of reaching your desired outcome. That's right. What's happening here, right? So they've created like, you know, algorithm. They've like parsed through the data and they've thought, okay, how do people make decisions about what they're going to watch, or how do people make decisions about staying on Netflix? And there's obviously some kind of assumption being tested there that when you see people that you identify with, you're going to click on it.
Even if it's the same damn film that you wouldn't have wanted to watch anyways.
But what's weird about that is that, so I guess there's like two things going on. Like one, if it encourages you to watch a film you wouldn't otherwise watch because you're not represented, but it's still good, then they're kind of winning on the discovery. But on the cynical side of things, they are kind of like manipulating us to some extent, because they're like, oh, you want to see films with black leads? Here you go. And actually, they're not a black lead. So that last part is a bit shady. And for me, it brings it more back to that idea that we always have around like the ethics of AI and the ethics of algorithms. Because like we were talking about YouTube last week being so good playlist. And knowing us so well, you just want to listen to music for 10 minutes and an hour in, you're like raving in your kitchen, you know? Yeah. So what happens now with this Netflix algorithm? Because if the duty of the Netflix algorithm is to, help me discover content more effectively, is it right or wrong?
I mean, like, that's the problem when you just optimize for the sake of optimization. Because you could, eventually, if you optimize any product, eventually you're just going to end up with porn. If you want to maximize engagement, you see what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Yeah, like, even like for this podcast, for example, I was talking to my girlfriend and I was like, we kind of made it more tech and pop culture. Where in the beginning, maybe we're more tech focused, right? Just because I can see from the data, this is what people enjoy. And she was like, so what happens if you optimize to the point where the only thing people want to hear is just pop culture stuff? And I'm like, well, then kind of, I wouldn't do that because I don't want to optimize to that extent. And I feel like this is the case where Netflix is like, F it, we're going to optimize to the point where like it's not even ethical, it's deceptive. It's
engage, deceptive. Ultra optimization mode.
Like some of these characters are in the film for like 5 minutes and you're putting them on the poster. Like, just because something works doesn't mean you should do it.
Or,
you see what I'm saying?
You should let me fast forward to the point that they're in, watch that, and then bounce.
Your own personalized edit. Where it's like a 5 minute film of the black character walking in. Hey guys, walk off scene, cut film, end film.
So wait a minute. If I like dogs, right, and I only watch things about dogs, Marley and Me and whatever, does that mean that Netflix is going to start showing me the album art or movie art cover, whatever?
Potentially, if your viewing history reflects that. If your viewing history reflects that, then it probably
would. So
there's
like 12 seconds of a dog and 12 years a slave.
I got a Netflix abacus, it's just bare pets. I'm thinking, why is there so many pets on your thing? Anyways.
Wow. Oh, if someone works at Netflix, though, I wanna hear more about the logic behind that. And I want to know if there's
any background. So supposedly they've released an article explaining the cover up.
Let's dive deep.
But this is beforehand. This is before the controversy came in.
Yeah.
So they realized that. They published their algorithm, said, oh, this is what we do, like, we personalize cover art, and it's led to this. They were proud of it, essentially.
Wow,
they were like, engagement is through the roof. Anyways, it's a really interesting story. I'll put the article.
Does that mean
that
there's, like, someone else's Netflix, which has, like, known characters that are not white somewhere
white, the whole way through.
I guess that's just, like, default Netflix before they did this.
That's pretty much it. Yeah,
Tamagotchis.
No, guess again.
Those trainers that you like, sneakers even, that you pump the tongue of the shoe and then they give you extra bounce.
I don't even know what that
is. From the 90s.
Like
they would have like a little...
I never heard of that one.
You would like pump... Come on, people listening. You would like pump the tongue of your shoe.
I could be completely ignorant. Yeah.
Pump, like a little basketballs on the front. And apparently they're supposed to give you extra bounce in your heels. Like there was an air thing. Like Air Maxes, you know that bubble in the sole? You would pump that to make it bigger. And then they would just like help you play basketball better.
I'm so baffled, and it went any of what you just said there. Oh, so okay, what it fine. Is
I give up.
So what it is, it was a website that Gen Z might not know about. It's called MySpace.
Oh my god, MySpace. Who's the guy that would always be your first friend?
Tom.
Yeah,
you know Tom's hood rich. Tom sold his company for like 500 mil.
Did he sell it to Justin Timberlake?
No, he sold it to Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch, for like 500 mil, and then they purchased it at the peak of like the whole MySpace bubble. And then eventually Murdoch's company, Fox, had to sell it to Justin Timberlake for like 20 mil.
Wow.
So he got away scot clear and is like super rich for the rest
man.
Of his life.
Tom,
like,
if you're listening, come on, Tekish.
Yeah.
Tell us how you're spending that dough.
Right, he was everyone's friend. I used to love Tom. But anyway, so I'm going about this story the long way around. It's not actually the return of MySpace. Basically, basically, Facebook now is going to allow you to put music on your profile, basically, and list like your top tunes that you're listening to, or whatever.
Because what I'm listening to is my identity. When I was a teenager, I'd be like, oh, I'm really into like punk rock now because I have an edge. Yeah, man.
I wouldn't have offended you then.
Oh, sorry.
This is the thing about MySpace though. I used to hate about the product. You go to someone's profile and the music would just blare out. You remember, like, and
sometimes it'd be so annoying as
Oh man, and like, people's profiles would be like seizure inducing. You'd be you could HTML it, like,
that's
I just customize it.
And like the background would be popping, and it would be like light pink writing on neon green background.
Yeah, but I think MySpace, some of the features that they had, like that, showing music, showcasing your personality, showcasing your top friends, a lot of that stuff actually was really popular.
Oh, yeah.
But they messed the product up in many other ways. Like, a lot of that stuff, people really engaged with that. Oh, this is my top five friends. Yeah. Everyone would be like, oh, I want to be your top five friends and whatever. So Facebook has taken a cue from their playbook and allowing music on the profile. It won't let you stream the whole song.
Yeah.
I think they're going to set up a partnership maybe with Apple or Spotify in the future.
They better do some integrating.
But I think it will show you like the, you know, the first 30 seconds. And it's interesting because music is such a part of people's, you know, persona and identity. Like,
yeah, of course.
Like, if you're a cool kid, you want to be like, I'm listening to the new song that you don't know about. I'm a hipster, like, you don't know about this song. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. How important do you think it is to be able to personalize your social media profile? Because to the point you're making, you know, when social media first started, or at least when I first started getting into it, we were like pre-teens, teenagers. Yeah. I don't know. But I remember when I was at boarding school, I don't know about my first one. It might have been MySpace or Friendster. But Bebo was the one. Yeah, like, Bebo, we were obsessed with that during GCSEs. Like, literally, like, every revision break would just be like, ooh, who's written on my Bebo wall? Do you remember you could draw, like, pictures? It was like Microsoft Paint was, like, integrated into the web app. And you could, like, draw, and we would, like, draw rude things or, like, tease people or, like, write nicknames.
Okay, I'm
no, you know, hey, it was all girls boarding school. Yeah, so that's it. What do you think we're going to get up to? But anyway, I've just felt that there was always this kind of like obsession with personalization. And then even, you know, starting university with Facebook, people would change their profile pictures all the time. You change your profile picture, update your status. You're always trying to like kind of differentiate yourself. And I feel like now what I observe, it could be a part of my age, but is this real sort of standardization. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
Like, even when you look at Instagram, like, everyone has like story cover art instead of just having like the screen grab from their story.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
that
never used to be there. And then a few people started doing it, and now everyone has it.
It looks good though.
It does look good, but I'm just
doing
saying,
that
like,
soon.
What?
I'm gonna do that soon. I can't be bothered. I haven't set up yet, but I'll get around to doing
that. But what I'm trying to say is, like, you know, where is the personalization?
Yeah, I think Facebook was the one that set that trend because, most people left MySpace to go to Facebook, and Facebook was a clean design. You couldn't customize your page. It was pure, like, just white, blue, like, really minimalistic design. And actually, a lot of people liked that because MySpace got too messy. Like, everyone's profile was completely different. It was this hodgepodge of different colors.
Yeah.
And
like
I said,
Tumblr.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, Facebook.
I like Tumblr.
Tumblr was really good at one point. It was really
good. It's still good.
It got purchased by Yahoo, right? And it's like, I don't know what's happened to it really. But at one point, a lot of like, a lot of the people that were on IG that you would consider to be like the trendsetters now, they were like the Tumblr kids.
Yeah, that's true,
you know,
true,
right?
Like,
they were the kind of, that's where a lot of culture and whatnot happened. But yeah, it's all about a balancing act. I think Facebook went in the direction of having no personalization really and truly. And then now they kind of, I think if they're smart, they should take some of what worked from MySpace, like music, maybe top friends. I don't know, that might get too political. You know, I don't think I'll be an ABBA's top friend, so I might be able to
like, that's cool, man. You can work for it. You can try.
But yeah, interesting.
Who does this speak to, though? So, for example, I feel that when you're younger, let's say a teenager or a pre-teenager, you really are way more into discovering music and discovering yourself through music, more so than like in your 20s and 30s. Not to say that you enjoy music less, but you just kind of like know your groove and stuff.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, is this another attempt at Facebook trying to tap into that Gen Z audience?
Yeah,
they've got TBH, they're tweaking this, tweaking that.
100%, 100%. Yeah. They even cloned Musical.ly into their product.
Wow.
I don't use it. I never use Musical.ly. That's definitely like a Gen Z thing. So
Facebook are like existential crisis on the horizon.
Definitely, definitely, definitely. But yeah, watch your space. MySpace returns.
Do you know what? If Facebook really want to get Gen Z, why don't you put some of that profit into cleaning up the oceans? Because I was reading this article that apparently...
Where are you going with this? This is so random. I'm looking at Apple like, where are you going with this?
Bearing
with you. All right, go on, explain.
I was reading about ocean plastics, which is a big issue for humanity and our planet right now. And this article was saying how Gen Z are one of the most like environmentally
conscious
generations. Like, sorry guys, I guess the millennials, you know,
yeah,
we weren't paying attention.
We're bad.
Sorry guys.
We're not good.
Anyway, they were saying that, yeah, like if brands want to better connect with Gen Z, then they should tell them how they're committed to saving their planet. So I'm just, so it's out the box thinking
every
here.
Every time you get a like, you know, we'll save a whale or something like that. All right,
yeah, or
cool.
Like scoop some plastic out of there. For another hustle tip, everybody likes them so much. I was recently asked at an event that I did, I basically said, I was talking about negotiation and some tactics you can use, and I was telling people that they should find accountability partners within their social network to sort of hold them accountable to the goal, whether that's asking for a pay rise, moving new jobs or whatever. Someone in the audience said to me, you know, what do you do if your friends aren't really into that kind of stuff, they're not like that, maybe they're not as ambitious as you. So really it just became a question of like, you know, how can you switch up your social circle?
Right.
So you're around the right people that sort of support your ambition, whether that's, you know, succeeding as a founder, succeeding within the tech world.
Right.
Is this something you've heard about before or like you've experienced or seen, observed?
I mean, I think everybody knows that phrase of, you know, you're the average of the five people that you hang around with. And there is a lot of truth to that statement. Pardon me. And I think someone in that position, definitely you've got to, you know, you've got to do the hard work of getting out of your house and going to meetups and just surrounding yourself with ambitious people. Find them. Where are they? Where are the people that are interested in what you're interested in? And just make sure that you're in their proximity, literally. I've always struggled with, you know, changing up your social circle. Like, I don't necessarily agree with completely changing it, because I think different people have different functions in your life, and you vice versa. Like, I have friends that are super ambitious that I've grown up with, and I have friends that, you know, stay at home and play video games all day.
Yeah.
And I haven't completely
cut those... That's me, by the way.
You're right. I haven't cut those people off. Like, I know some people are a lot more ruthless. They're like, I cut those people off. But sometimes I want to just play video games for like an hour and just be a knucklehead. Like, why not, kind of thing? But you've got to be careful not to let those people have any influence in your life. This sounds really ruthless, but I'm keeping it 100 now. But if you've got, let's say, all of your friends are like that, that's difficult. That's when you've got to make a conscious effort to go out, meet those people, engage with the new people, go to meetups, go to, you know, networking events, as cliche as it sounds. Even join online communities.
Yeah.
Because a lot of our interactions now with our friends, let's keep it real, it's a WhatsApp group. It's an IG group now. Like, and sometimes you need to be in a lot of those kind of super positive, super ambitious ones, just so that your mental energy is filled with positivity, as cliche as this all sounds.
Yeah.
I don't know, is anything I'm saying ringing true to you?
No, I think you're right. I think it's about striking the balance. But I do still, like, to your point, yes, you know, strike the balance. One of the things I love about, like, Rihanna, whenever I'm, like, on her Instagram, is
Rihanna,
actually,
you say, oh, Riri, yeah, bad girl, Riri. Cool, yeah.
But, like, she's still, like, friends with all of her friends,
day
like,
ones.
From Barbados, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think... I can't even imagine what it must be like to go from, like, you know, normal life, to be plucked from obscurity, to then being, you know, one of the most recognizable faces on a planet of,
yeah,
like,
nuts.
10 billion people.
Yeah, that's nuts.
I can't imagine what that must be like. So, of course, there's value in staying connected to your roots. We've talked about Ye in the past and how, like, he got too far
gone.
Yeah,
that's what could happen.
So, yeah, it's like, right, you got to stay connected to your roots. However, at the same time, there are some connections which are toxic. And I think as we grow older, we start to recognize those ones which maybe are a net loss overall when we think of all the interactions. And I'd say if you just wish that there were more ambitious people in your phone book that you could call upon when you're trying to work through a problem or whatever, then you should probably spend a bit more time, like, online or in networking events. And don't worry about, oh, I'm not extroverted, I'm not introverted. I did a workshop yesterday and someone said, you know, I want to build my network, but I'm an introvert. And I said, you know, I consider myself an ambivert. It's like, there are times when I'm happy to be extroverted, but there are also times when I have serious social anxiety or I just get very drained by people.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what I would say is put yourself out there. Talk in the open about what you're working on, about what you aspire to, what your ambitions are. Write about them on Medium, share them on Twitter or Instagram, whatever social media platform you like. You can start your own blog if that's what you would prefer. But just start telling your story so that people who are interested in that story and, you know, also out there trying to strive for things can connect with you. And if you feel confident enough to, like, put yourself out there in real life, then go to events.
Shout out to Nafisa of Amalia.com. She wrote an amazing article on
Forbes.
talking about, you know, initiatives that are doing work to kind of change startup culture. And she shouted out Techish. Woo! That's my first Forbes plug. And
yeah.
Also Pocket. But I was just super pleased that, you know,
getting recognized. Yeah,
no, obviously not just that we're getting recognized, but also just the fact she's in our peer group in a sense that she's an entrepreneur that's kind of come up around the same time as us, and she was given an opportunity and she kind of plugged us as well. I like when people kind of give and as well as take, like, and that's a really beautiful thing, you know what I'm saying? But yeah, shout out to Forbes, shout out to Nafisa, shout out to Amalia,
thank her you company.
Like, it was a dope thing. I'll put it in the show notes. While ago, and people kind of resonate with it. I basically said this, I'll quote myself, that's how important I am. In the 3 years since starting Pocket, I've discovered that accolades, press, publicity, and love from peers has virtually near zero impact on the health of your overall venture entity or company. Focus on stakeholders, in brackets, readers, customers, users, etc. Now, Abba, do you agree with that, or do you think I'm talking rubbish?
I think that's an oversimplification. Yeah. I definitely agree that there are a lot of people who are getting a lot of press, winning a lot of awards. But if you actually press them to like demonstrate the value that their work has created, it'll be hard to find those results.
Okay.
Like,
yeah,
without
yeah.
a doubt, without
that's
a doubt.
That's such a polite way of saying it. Like, they're BSing. But okay, got it. Yeah, I love it. The way you said it there.
However, at this and by the same token, there are so many companies you never even hear about, not even make
under
any list, any awards, but they're banking profit. They're just like going crazy.
Making bank on the slide.
Yeah, exactly. Just doing super, super well. So yeah, I definitely think that all of these awards and stuff like aren't necessarily like an indicator of health. However, it's very unlikely that there's like inverse correlation between like the number of awards you've won and the amount your business is growing.
Right.
Like, I reckon it has to be a positive correlation, because when people see you, that is like some kind of social proof. I guess it depends on your company, but like, one, more people know about you. For example, I've literally had people follow me on Instagram and send me a DM being like, oh, I discovered you because you were featured on this blog.
Right.
Or I discovered you because you were featured there. And same kind of thing with like, you know, companies and stuff like that. Like, I was recently invited to speak at like the government, basically.
Woo!
Department for Culture, Media and
Illuminati.
Sport.
And then Illuminati.
Thanks, bro.
Freemasons.
Just getting in there, mulling away. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that couldn't have happened without that. So
yeah.
What were people's responses? What did people say?
I think most people were agreed. I agree with you though that, yeah, you can take that argument and say this is a gross oversimplification. I tried to, you know, have the proviso that has virtually a near zero impact.
I mean, there is
like some impact. Don't get twisted. Like you said, it's very good for credibility.
Mm.
And it's also very good for team morale. If you're running a startup and you're like, okay, guys, we're in this magazine. Like, it looks good for the team and everyone kind of, like, I'm sure Arlen Hamilton on the cover of, you know, Fast Company.
Yeah.
Felt amazing to her and her team and kept them going. What I mean, it has virtually no zero impact on the health of your venture. Is that, let's say you've got an early stage startup.
Yeah.
And let's say your company suffers from the problem of what I call a leaky bucket. That means customers come in, but they don't become long-term users, right? What good is it for you to get a million impressions from TechCrunch? And I've been in TechCrunch, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I've seen the spike and then it does nothing afterwards because we didn't have like an email landing page set up.
Yeah.
We didn't have like a whole bunch of stuff to capture that attention and to take that forward long-term. We hadn't focused on the health of our baby at the time.
Yeah.
Too busy worrying about who we're appearing to, what accolades we're getting. And it had zero impact, because if you've got a leaky bucket, it's all going out the other way.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? Like,
that's a good point.
I had much better love just talking to my top customers saying, how can we help you? What can we do? What are we doing wrong? What are we doing right? Then being like, you know, and we were in Forbes recently and that was amazing. Don't get twisted. But if I hadn't sorted things out with my business, it would have been completely counterproductive. I would have been like, yo, we've got all this traffic and I don't know what to do with it. Like, and it's not working. And my business is like, you know, the engine isn't running.
And the ironic thing is, all of the, like, you gotta apply for awards.
That's true.
And that takes up so much time. Or you have to make yourself available for an interview, and that takes up so much time. Like, for example, I know that Ryan Hoover, the founder of Product Hunt, who I work with, turns down things so often because he's like, I just don't have time. I'm running a business. I'm running a fund. I can't do that.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. Like, if someone's out there trying to optimize for awards, their business is going to die.
Yeah.
You need to be optimizing for growth, profit, new customers, retention, whatever it is. And it is funny, actually, because I've been at a lot of events recently. And people are always like, oh my gosh, you know, you're doing so well. Hey, I'm doing better than I was last year, but I still don't have a sustainable business.
There we go.
Like most startups in their year two of life.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to get there.
Still a baby, right?
So yeah, it's all about, it can be a false indicator too, for sure.
Yeah. But like you said, it is a gross oversimplification. I know, like, for example, I mentioned Arlen Hamilton, like, just looking from the outside, she has parlayed, you know, the justified media attention that she has into, you know, a wonderful entity, which is Backstage Capital. I don't think Backstage would be where it is if she hadn't, you know, had the amazing PR that she deserves. So I don't want to go too far the other end and say PR has no value. It obviously does. Mm. But it's not the be all and end all. And I think that's what I should have really said.
Yeah.
Shout out to Ethiopia. They have appointed the first head of state who is a woman in modern era. Her name is Miss Sahel Werk. I'm trying to get my Habsha pronunciations down right. I might have got that wrong. She's the first female president, like I said. And actually, just before that, they had appointed a 50-50 male-female cabinet.
What?
And Rwanda also has done something similar.
Other countries so step up.
Us in the West, we're out here talking about human rights.
Africa!
Human rights, democracy, you guys need to fix up. And it's like, you know, we're getting put to shame out here, man. So
they have matriarchs, I guess, in like African history.
Yeah, you're right, actually. That might actually... And,
so it's not alien to us.
People had to correct a lot of the articles because they were like, actually, you know, we've had like empresses in Ethiopia who are like, you know, women and whatnot. But in the modern era, this was the first woman president. I think the president role in Ethiopia is relatively ceremonial, and the prime minister is where a lot of the power is held. Yeah. But it's still like a great step forward.
Still
like,
important.
Yeah, even as a figurehead.
Yeah, I was so surprised. I was doing some research the other day. Women at UN or Women of UN, one of those bodies in the UN concerned with women.
One of those people.
Talked about, in a research paper, they said that, you know, there's almost 200 countries in the world.
Mm.
And out of that number, guess how many heads of state in 2016 were women? Almost 200 countries,
10,
okay?
10.
Damn it.
Exactly.
11. 11. I should have bet money on
that. That's trash, though.
That is so frustrating and
trash.
Disappointing. I am a woman, and that makes me so angry.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, I'm a person who identifies as a man, and I am angry as well. Like,
that's this, not this, right.
This is like what she said. This is her quote, and I love it. Yeah, she says, "I urge all of you to uphold our peace," which is basically the relatively newfound peace between Eritrea and Ethiopia. She says, "I urge all of you to uphold our peace in the name of a mother who is the first to suffer from the absence of peace."
Aww.
And like, she brings that perspective. Do you know what I'm saying? It might be a cliche, but do you think women are less likely to go to war? I personally think that is the case.
That's so interesting.
You know, I don't know. I feel like sometimes there's too much ego. I don't want to generalize. Obviously, there are very hot-headed women and they're very hot-headed men. But like, you'd think just like on a human level, that as a mother, like you would just understand that, listen, the cost of human life is so much greater than like, these are our sons out here. And like, maybe men were just too cavalier and just be like, yeah, you know, send 200,000 guys out there. Like, who cares?
Obviously, I'm biased, but I do think the world would be better if it was... I'm joking. I actually think it's human beings that are violent.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a really good book by Naomi Alderman called Power, which sort of plays on like a kind of role reversal between men and women. And I encourage anyone to read it if they haven't. It's a novel. It's really good. I of course, if there were more women in leadership, if leadership was just more representative of society's demographics, so imagine it was like equally proportional. I mean, that would be unlikely, but like, let's just say in an ideal utopia, X percent of people in the population, X percent of them making decisions about the world, then I think we would probably have less violence overall.
Okay, yeah, I don't think that's quite a special thing to say. I agree. Yo, everybody, that brings episode 28. Thanks so much for listening, guys. We really appreciate it. Please, please, please leave a review on iTunes. It really helps with the algorithm and whatnot. Leave a detailed review as possible. We love you. We've got a Patreon as well. Check that out. Go to our website. You'll be able to find all of it, techishpod.com. And yeah, we'll catch you next week. See you later.
Bye.